The When Dating Hurts podcast is sponsored by Nom Nom. I'm a big advocate for better food for pets. When they eat healthier, they live healthier. And Nom Nom's food for dogs is full of fresh proteins a dog loves and the vitamins and nutrients they need to thrive. Nom Nom meals are pre-portioned for your dog's exact caloric needs. So it's the easiest way to take the guesswork out of feeding your dog the best. Just tell them about your pup, age, breed, weight, allergies, and protein preferences. Get fresh, prepackaged, totally nutritious meals delivered directly to your door for even less. Order Nom Nom today. Go to trynom.com/whendatinghurts and get 50% off your first order, plus free shipping. And Nom Nom comes with a money-back guarantee. That means if your dog doesn't love each meal, Nom Nom will refund your first order. Nom Nom is real good food for your dog. Head to trynom.com/whendatinghurts. The When Dating Hurts podcast is supported by BlendJet. Big, bulky blenders are a real pain to use, but the BlendJet 2 blender makes blending a snap. I'm using mine several times a day. Convenience is the reason why. The BlendJet 2 is portable, so you can blend up a smoothie at work, a protein shake at the gym, or even a margarita on the beach. It can fit into your cup holder, but powerful enough to blast through tough ingredients like ice and frozen fruit with ease. And BlendJet 2 is whisper quiet, so you can make your morning smoothie without waking up the whole house. BlendJet lasts for 15 or more blends and recharges quickly via USB-C. Best of all, BlendJet 2 cleans itself. Just blend water with a drop of soap and you're good to go. With over 30 plus colors and patterns to choose from, there's a BlendJet 2 to complement any style. Blend anytime, anywhere with the BlendJet 2 portable blender. Seriously, what are you waiting for? No other blender on the market comes close to the quality, power, and innovation of the BlendJet 2. They guarantee you'll love it or your money back. Shop today and get the best deal ever. Head to BlendJet.com and use the promo code WhenDatingHurts12 for your 12% off your order and free 2-day shipping. That's BlendJet.
Hi, everybody. I highly recommend the When Dating Hurts podcast. I found the podcast after I left an abusive relationship, but it continuously helps me on my healing journey. The podcast always reminds me that these people are damaged, they're emotionally draining, and they're dangerous to be around. I appreciate everything Bill has done for people like me. It keeps me from ever even considering going back. Love should not hurt. You deserve respect more than anything in a relationship. Take your power back and live the life you want to live. You deserve it.
The When Dating Hurts podcast continues to grow in popularity. The more who listen, the more who will know the realities of dating and domestic violence. In the meantime, the When Dating Hurts book in paperback, ebook, and audiobook is being purchased and read by concerned parents, teachers, victims and survivors, and of course, those who are currently dating. Education leads to empowerment. That way, if a potential abuser is targeting you or someone you care about, you will know how to detect it and how to break free and stay safe. Up next, another survivor story to illustrate how an innocent person can become manipulated and trapped in abusive relationships. This is part two of my conversation with Marie, and she will talk about the ongoing relationship she had with Jake. And just about any time in this that we think that things might come to an end, they just kind of keep going. So here's that conversation.
At this point, I transferred colleges just because wasn't loving North Dakota. I transferred to a UW school that was closer to Minnesota. It was only about an hour away from my house. And Jake would still talk to me. And he would reach out to me and started saying things like, oh, I just miss you. I miss your presence. I miss you being around me. And I would kind of play strong for a while. And I'd be like, you know, it's funny that you say you miss me, but every time I'm around, you treat me so terribly. And he's like, well, you know, I'm changing. I'm growing every day. I'm developing my new character and I'm going to get a job and all these things. He did actually get a job. He went to trade school and he became a welder. So that's his now profession of choice. And he's been in welding now for over 2.5 years. And I kind of re-roped Jake back into my life. Nothing super substantial had happened after he had gotten off drugs and he had maintained his sobriety to some extent, but he always went back to it. So he would be sober long enough to pass a drug test to get his welding job. And then he'd be back to drinking and using drugs again. And then he would say things like, oh, I'm just California sober, so I don't use hard drugs anymore, but I can still drink and smoke weed and do whatever I want, and it's fine. And that kind of just started to make me uncomfortable. I didn't really like being around it anymore because of the things that I had seen while he was using drugs. So I had expressed that to him, and he was just like, you're so childish, you're so juvenile, like you can't handle seeing someone on drugs, like what are you going to do in your job? And all these things like that, because part of my future career would be working with criminals and people in mental health, which we'll touch on. And he just started to belittle me in that way again. So he would be friendly, but then he'd have his touches of like, you're not good enough. You're not going to succeed in your career. You'll never be able to help people. All of those things in there.
Why do you think he was doing that? Why did he keep having to pinprick you with that stuff, do you think?
For me, I feel like he knew that I would stick around. And then at this point, my self-esteem was very low. And I think he kind of picked up on that. He knew exactly what to say to make me feel like crap about myself. So I was like, you know, starting to believe these things, like maybe he is right. Maybe I'm not going to be good in my career. I'm not going to be able to help people. I'm not that pretty. I'm not a catch, everything like that. So my self-esteem just got so worn down that I was like, Jake treats me terribly, but at least he still talks to me.
I can imagine getting to that place. I really can. Where it's, it isn't great, but it's something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's exactly how I'd describe it too.
And he was quite the puppeteer. You know, he really had you, had you going.
Yeah, he did. I ended up graduating college from the UW school. I graduated with a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and a bachelor's degree in psychology. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my two fields of choice. And then during my undergrad, I pursued a probation internship and I worked with high-risk male domestic violence offenders. I felt kind of bad pursuing this internship because I had just applied for a general probation internship and it was just coincidental that I got assigned to the DV unit. And I was like, well, maybe it's fate. You know, I can kind of see the other side, learn more maybe about Jake's thought process and people like him. So I'm in this internship and I'm shadowing all these client visits. None of these people were actively incarcerated. They were all people in the community. We would go to their houses. We would go to their job sites, everything like that. Because probation, you can kind of do whatever, kind of show up when you want. So it's kind of part of the deal when you're on probation here. Mm-hmm. I had been shadowing that. And the clients that I had, I just found it so hard to empathize with them, especially having read things like their police reports from their initial calls that landed them in this situation, seeing their attitudes surrounding their victims, because this situation was unique because I had contact not only with the domestic violence offenders, but I had contact with the woman they have victimized as well. And that was a part of the gig.
That's an amazing dual viewpoint that you had access to. I mean, that's just...
Yeah.
That's amazing. I'm impressed that you had that. So what can you tell us? I mean, this is unique.
During my internship, learned a lot. I was exposed to so many things and so many different types of people. I would say the main thing that I saw was the classic excuses for the behavior. And it was a lot of parallels to Jake as well. Even how people would treat me as an intern and how people would treat my mentor, the lead probation officer. So usually when people would first get assigned onto the caseload, they would say, I'm going to be your best client. You're never going to have to worry about me. I'm going to meet all my conditions. I'll follow everything perfectly and to a T. I will not be an issue for you. And I found that to be very interesting because I felt like it was almost kind of a ploy to say, like, I've done these things, and it's kind of a half own that they've done things, but they're trying to reiterate that they are a good person or they are not as bad as they may look on paper.
Which is part of manipulation to the person hearing it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're working it on you. The same voodoo is coming your way that they have put on other people, including the person they victimized, right?
Absolutely. And it would not take long at all for them to show the true colors out. You know, at this point, I had been with Jake for years. I had distanced myself from him by this point, but still kind of lingering in the back of my mind. And I was kind of thinking back on our relationship and what that had looked like and, you know, trying to see the parallels between Jake and the clients that I had on this caseload. So they'd be great, perfect model citizens for the first like month they were on probation. Then after that, pretty much it was the classic BS that you hear. Probation officers take a lot of crap, man. They really do. Especially with the people that you work with. No one is happy to see their PO. Never. And people were just so rude. They were like, honestly, I don't care that I lost custody of my kids. You can't make me do these things. You can put a warrant out for me and you can try to come and find me, but I'm not going to tell you where I am. Or they would just kind of own their thing of saying, I'm going to do my conditions, but just so you know, the second I'm off my probation, I'm going to do it again and I'm going to do it worse. Oh. So they would be these picture perfect people, models, and then they would just kind of play the system of knowing that they can't get in trouble. They would follow their conditions and then they would go back into society kind of having played the criminal justice system.
How'd that make you feel when you saw that in action? You saw the whole spectrum of, you know, good boy, bad boy.
For me, it felt terrible. I felt terrible because a lot of people are not happy to be on probation, but it really is focused on offender rehabilitation. At the county I worked at, they had access to chemical dependency services. They had access to therapy. They had access to restorative justice. And for those that are listening but don't know, restorative justice is a practice where you bring in the victim, you bring in the offender, there's mediators, and you can kind of hash everything out outside of the legal system as a way to heal everyone involved. So that was a part of it. And there were so many resources at these people's disposal. So it was just so disheartening to hear that they had everything in their power to be able to change, and they were still actively choosing to not be good people at the end of the day.
One thing that I've thought about at times is that at the center of all this is usually power and control over another person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so no matter how you serve it up, you could serve it up as nicely as possible. Everybody's in the room, everybody's acting nicely. But the bottom line is that the request, however much icing you put on it, is that you're not going to be the king of this world anymore. Mm-hmm. You're going to share it, but you got to be nice. You can't be physical. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things, like the whole toolkit's kind of being thrown away. So no matter how you send it up, with all the right people in the room, everybody speaking quietly, aren't we asking somebody to do something that at their core, they have no interest in God's green earth to do?
Yeah. And that's kind of how it was with all the clients. I think there was probably two of them on my caseload where I would actually consider them rehabilitated individuals. They were actually honest. They didn't just feed BS at me when we had our client visits. And they were actually trying. And for one of those clients, they were battling an alternative thing. So they were dealing with schizophrenia while they were juggling the court system. And they did not want to be medicated. So that was a part of that unique issue because it was the paranoia that was kind of the driver of that situation of, are you out to get me? I need to get you first before you can get me. I see. That was a very unique situation that I would say, but I wouldn't say that's the majority of domestic violence offenders at all. I feel like it's usually, you know, you see the narcissistic personality disorders, things like that. It's a rare case to see that alternative driver that may actually be a reasonable explanation for the way they had acted towards another individual.
That's a good insight. One question I'd like to ask you is terms like narcissist or narcissistic, mm-hmm. terms like psychopath, sociopath. How do you explain those different terms? They kind of get tossed around and scrambled together, and mm-hmm. it's, I think they get used interchangeably. How do you delineate each of those?
I would say narcissistic personality disorder is kind of the secret undercover personality disorder. It's not that many people in the world have it, but it's most people in the world that do have it share kind of the same symptom set, which is kind of unique to narcissistic personality disorder. Because, for example, if you look at bipolar disorder, which is a mood disorder, it's not in the same category. You can have a list of these 15 symptoms, but if you compare two bipolar individuals, they may not struggle with the same symptoms at all. Versus with narcissistic, I feel like you have those more classic presentations of doing things for themselves, turning things on to others. Everything is ultimately kind of based in selfishness when you're looking at narcissistic personality disorder. It's the way that they can elevate themselves and kind of perform in that light. I would say for sociopathic behavior and then psychopathic behavior, I feel like those get changed around a lot.
Yes.
Even sometimes through my criminal justice career, I'd be like writing a paper and I'm like, is that a sociopath or a psychopath? Because they get interchanged so much.
Yes, they do.
But I would say sociopathic behaviors, I would say, is more severe. It's less treatable than psychopathic. I think psychopathic is demeaned more of like, oh, he's a psychopath, stay away from him. And it's used a lot in true crime, I would say. But I actually think sociopathic behavior is a little more severe in nature.
Part of what goes with just about all of those, mm-hmm. again, for those who don't study this or do it for a living, mm-hmm. it seems like it comes down to, like you said, there's a high degree of selfishness, probably within all of them, however they got there.
Yeah.
High degree of mm-hmm. selfishness and the old, in quotes, it's all about me. Mm-hmm. But it seems like from what I hear, again, this is so unscientific, it's ridiculous. But for a narcissist, it seems like it's something they can kind of turn on and off. The mask, as we talked about earlier in our chat, they can kind of go there and they can kind of seem like, wow, what a charming, wonderful person, and love bombing you or picking up some nice toys for you and sprinkling them on you. Wow, you bought me a new phone. That's so great. You know, all these things, but it's an act. It seems like a sociopath has a very difficult time even getting to that place where they don't even want to think about the mask. It's like, this is the way I am. That's the way it is. I don't care about your feelings. I'm never going to look like I care about your feelings. You know, I don't care if you like it.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that explanation. You know, with NPD, they just kind of, like you said, put on that mask to keep people around, because then they can utilize all the resources that individual has to offers. And it's kind of remained in that person's disposal of, oh, I was good to this person, so I can use them for this. And that's kind of how I've perceived narcissistic personality disorder versus like the sociopathic behavior, like you had mentioned. They just don't care at all. They don't care to change. And they kind of own that they're not going to change.
Oddly enough, if you think of it, a sociopath actually is kind of a more honest way to be, because it's like, mm-hmm. you see, you know, you get what you see.
Yeah.
I didn't pull a Prince Charming on you. That whole part didn't mm-hmm. happen. It's just, here it is. Mm-hmm. Like it or leave it. Here it is.
Absolutely.
It wasn't false advertising. Mm-hmm. So you and Jake, eventually this must come to a close with him.
Kind of does. So...
Okay,
that's kind of interesting.
That's got my attention. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah.
He's not going to walk into the room, is he, in the moment?
No. Oh, God. Okay. No. So it was kind of around this time. I would say, I think it was my junior year of college. So I'm at UW and stuff. And I was on break. I was at his house just hanging out because he had roped me back in again. And he gets this call on his phone. And I was like, who is that? Whatever. Because the contact name was like something weird. It was like Candyland. So I was like, okay, is he using drugs again? Like, is that like a smart play on words? Come to find out, it was a girl that he had nicknamed Candyland. And they had sex unprotected. She got pregnant. And he had ghosted her for the past 6 weeks. While she had been trying to call him and contact him to let him know that she was pregnant. And he finally had answered her call And I was like, you know, Jake, just answer the phone. Like, that's so rude to not answer it. And so he did. And he just had this look of shock, like wash over his face. And I kind of just said out loud, I was like, she's pregnant, isn't she? And he was like, yes, like you need to leave right now because she's on the way to my house. I was like, oh, crap. Because I had, I'm kind of a nosy person. So at this time, I was like, I kind of wished I could sit upstairs and just kind of eavesdrop on, you know, everything going on. But I did leave because I was like, if she finds me, that's just going to be so uncomfortable for everyone. You know, we weren't doing anything at this point. It was kind of just more of a friendship based, I would say. I still was into him, but wasn't involving anything like that. So I left. And then he had called me after she had went home. And he was like, you know, yeah, Candyland is pregnant and I'm going to have her get an abortion. I can't be a father. I don't want to be tied to her for the rest of my life. I would never want to marry someone like her. So all the classic behaviors just start coming out. In my mind, when you're an adult and you consent to these things and you participate in those activities and, you know, the result of procreation is potentially a child, I don't think it's fair to say I would never want to marry her. I'd never want her to be the mother of my child when you were willing to participate in the activity that gets you a child.
Yes.
Yeah. I bring that up because he then at this point, she ended up getting an abortion. He paid for it because he was like, it's the least I can do. I was like, okay. And he was like, I need you at my house. So I was like, why? You have all these things going on. Like, why do I need to be there? And so he brought her to the procedure, drove her home, and then he was at his house. And I show up because I had felt bad for the situation because I had had another friend go through an abortion. It was very hard on her. And so I had never seen it from the male perspective of the things that I guess you can experience. So I went over there and once again, just like blackout drunk as a way to cope with everything, slurring his words, crying, doing all these things and just going back to like the, I'm such a POS, like I'm a terrible guy. Like, you know, I should never be anyone's father, but I want kids so badly and just couldn't have been her. I couldn't have had it with her. And then he started making comments of like, it could be with you. And I was like, is that seriously what is on your mind right now? Like you just had a girl get an abortion for you yesterday. And your reaction is to want to try to have a kid with me now. Like that is so delusional in your thinking. Like that's insane to me. Like that is so insane. I just ended up leaving. I was like, I don't want to be around you. This is behavior is not acceptable. You're drinking again. You're doing these things. You're clearly going down a bad path once again. So I had just kind of left, taken a step back, and he constantly called, reached out to me, did whatever. And I was like, Jake, you know what? I support you in the things that you're doing. I hope you get better, but I cannot continue to be a part of this because there's no reason as to why I'm sitting here and I'm crying over an abortion that I wasn't even a part of because I've seen the detriment that is done to both of these people. I'm just like, I'm so sick of being this emotionally involved in your life when you throw me out like I'm a piece of trash at the gas station. Like I just was at my breaking point. I'm like, I cannot do this anymore. And then I kind of had my education backing me because I was looking into all these things. I was like, wow, like I actually faced these, all these issues when I was with Jake. Like it was all kind of like coming to light. It was almost, it felt like regaining like consciousness of the situation is how I would describe it. I just could not be a part of it anymore. I can't tell you honestly what the straw was that truly broke the camel's back because he had treated me terribly for over 4 years and I had stuck around. He could do whatever. I would come back. And, you know, it wasn't the situation that he had been in with this girl that like really ticked me off or anything. It was just kind of like that coming to my senses of being like, I just can't do this. I can't do this anymore. I just spent the summer working with DV victims. And I'm seeing this and I'm seeing that you're not changing. You make all these empty promises and I'm just like fed up. So I guess I am happy to say that I haven't seen Jake now in over a year.
Okay.
So that's good. But he still texts me all the time. Matter of fact, he just texted me last week and he was like, I miss you so much. Like, I wish you would come back around. And I don't have a valid reason as to why I haven't blocked him, because I think even though I've separated myself from him, deep down, I'm kind of like, maybe one day he will actually change and apologize. I have no need to hang out with him again. I've been avoiding his requests to hang out for me for a year now, but it's just different. And I always want to leave space open for people if they're able to actually apologize and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I believe if Jake ever wanted to actually change, he could, because he had to get psych evaluations and everything while he was in the rehabilitation center. And they did not find anything like antisocial personality disorder, narcissism. They didn't find those things. They only found that he had substance abuse and then clinical depression. So I'm like, there's not really a psychological explanation for the way that you use and abuse people. Mm-hmm. I've kind of kept that in the back of my head of, you know, maybe he will come to senses, maybe he will change, but I just have to completely space myself from that, especially since I'm going to be working in the mental health field and then hopefully doing some criminal justice reform work. I don't think it's the smartest decision for me to still be tied to this man who is an active felon and this, that, and other thing. I can't be this model person and advocating for these people and then, you know, going back to that situation myself. It just doesn't feel right to me, which is the best way that I can probably explain it.
Listening to everything you've been talking about, I would have anticipated you would have said you kind of left him in the rearview mirror and that's it. So I didn't think that there might still be some interest or some connection of any kind.
Yeah.
I have empathy for people, but I have more empathy for you. If I had my way, which I don't, but if I had my way, I would really wish that you would just make believe he doesn't exist and just move on.
Yeah.
You have so much going for you. You're so bright. You're so with it. So interesting. And, you know, one of the things that I said to someone years ago, I may have mentioned this on an earlier episode, but the line that I thought of that I asked her, and I said, I'm going to ask you a question, and I don't really want you to answer me or answer your mother who was sitting in the room. And I said, when you think of it at the age you are right now and everything you have going for yourself, do you think looking ahead, because you could live 60 or 70 years, do you think that this particular person is the best you can do? Is this it? Is this your ceiling? Is this person the best you can do? And it occurs to me talking with you that it's like you've done it. You know, you have done it again and again and again. And he might be somewhat different from the way he was, a little bit better. But you know as well as I do, these people slide. And you don't want to be there when that happens.
No.
So yeah. I just beg you, not only turn the page, but shut the book and then get rid of the book and just... It's not your job.
I totally get that too. And I've heard similar from my friends because they're like, just block him and move on. And I don't know what it is with me because it's not, I guess, even individualistic to Jake, but even like any man that I've had like a romantic situation with at all, I'm just like, I can never block them. It feels so permanent, but it would be best for me to just do that. And I don't know if it's like a power issue where it's kind of that type of thing of, you know, I'm finally the one like putting the hammer down. And I don't know if I have the strength to do that, even though for me, it's like, I see no future with Jake at all. In my mind, I have no more attraction to him. I have nothing like that, but it's just kind of like the, maybe he will apologize. And I feel like it would feel good. But thinking about my past with him, if he apologized, would it even be real? Or is it always just going to be another ploy to get me back in? And that's the more probable motive right there. Not that he's being serious or that he's had this coming to God or anything super crazy like that. It's just, it's going to be a ploy to get me back. And that's probably the way that Jake is going to be. And I feel for the women that have the misfortune of having to have him in their life. But yeah, that's kind of my take on it.
You've mentioned the apology a few times, but I look at that like it's just a collection of words that are sent up in a certain way to sound a certain way and to get a certain response. But what comes after that, who knows? Who absolutely knows? And I just don't think that it's your job to constantly be the person he can go to when he's finished with everybody else, which is not a great position. You weren't necessarily born to save that one person.
Yeah.
But I think of my daughter, that sometimes things can really get out of control and really get bad. Mm-hmm. And then it's over.
Yeah.
That would be one of those, every one of your friends would say, my God, we all saw it coming. Mm-hmm. And you don't want that one. You don't want that for you. You don't want that even for him, quite frankly, but, and you don't want that for your family, because your family then gets to relive that whole thing. It's like, oh my God, you know, we all saw this.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely agree with that. And it's bad too, because that's how I've kind of almost rationalized his behavior, because I've kind of seen, you know, the DV victims. I've heard about your daughter. I've heard other stories where it's such an unfortunate ending of such a violent crime against them. It's like the final straw. And usually with DV victims, it's not, you know, you don't see it where they just shoot them. It's usually like they get beat to death. They're stabbed. Very powerful endings. I feel like for me, I'm like, well, Jake was never that bad where I thought that. But the thing is, it's like pretty much anyone in DV has the potential to become that bad. And I know so much about DV and I have my education that I can always depend on. But I feel like it's just something that I have to work through, of like being able to finally close the door and, you know, making that final step of nailing it shut. And we're not going to go back, because he doesn't add anything to my life. And he will just always play the cycle of behavior of being the best guy ever. And then he's terrible and degrading. So I'm not really sure what my hang up necessarily is. I do have a therapist kind of work through that and the things I've endured in my life. So that's been really interesting to navigate. Mm-hmm. And she's been great. She, you know, makes comments. She's like, you've made so much progress, but it doesn't really feel like it, because I kind of sometimes still slip back into my old ways of being like, oh, I wonder how Jake's doing, but I don't text him. I don't reach out. I don't respond to his messaging. But, you know, I'm just like, maybe I'll see it, but I don't know.
There's one other person I've spoken with who had that same thing of bouncing back. And I said to her, and I've even since our interview have put this into emails to her, but I said, this is just the way I see it. This person is like a mild poison. Mm-hmm. Every time you're around that person, it's just another sip of poison. This person will poison your life. And that's it. I mean, I'm just kind of at that zero tolerance place. You've done enough that if that person had snapped out of it, cleaned up his act, done all the things he needed to do, and now was pretty terrific, you know, maybe actually pretty close to what you thought you met in the beginning, then I'd say, okay, you know, that's a rare thing, but you got it. You know, you got there. He got there. Yeah. But I don't feel that way. And I just feel like, quit sipping the poison. Nobody thinks it's good for you.
Yeah.
Again, is this the best you can do? It's definitely not.
No.
I mean, that's, you don't have to think too hard on that one.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to lecture you.
No, that's okay. I always appreciate hearing the different perspectives. You know, my friends have kind of had everything. And if you think you're being harsh, you cannot be any harsher than one of my dearest, closest friends. She's very blunt. So that ma'am could definitely clear a room with her opinions. And she's definitely got them in there. I love her for it. So she keeps me in check. It's great. I love hearing all that stuff.
How far back in your life does she go?
I met her in college, and it was funny because we didn't get along. We didn't get along because I was like, you're mean. And she was like, yeah, and you're meaner. And so then I was like, well, that was kind of how it was. And I was just, you know, dancing around.
You know, there's a thin line between being mean and being direct. Sometimes people who we think are mean are people who just don't sugarcoat something. They just tell you, this is the way I feel. And you go, ooh, that hurt. Well, it hurt. But the difference between me and a lot of other people is I'll tell you the truth.
Yeah.
At least the way I see it. Very direct. Just don't want to play around with all the trappings of serving it up just wonderfully.
That's how we both kind of are. We hate the fluff.
Right.
We just want to get
here it is.
Right into it. So, yeah.
Like it or hate it, here it is. And now you know what I'm thinking.
I feel like for me, for those listening, for you, Bill, one day, hopefully soon, I will be able to put that nail in the coffin for him, because it's not good. He is the poison in my life. And it feels a little hypocritical of me to, you know, have worked with DV people see people who have suffered from DV, know so much about it, and then to put myself back in the situation. And it's a little different when you're inside of it, because you can always look at something from a third perspective when you're not involved and be like, gosh, like, that's terrible. When you're in it, it's just, it's so weird the way you feel. It's just, you know, kind of that lock of perspective that you gain, and you're kind of just tunnel visioned in. But I think I'm finally getting to that point of, we're going to be done, because I haven't seen him in so long. So just for those, I'm like, hold hope for me that I'm able to pursue that and go on with my life and be able to actually help others and the way I want to do in my career working in criminal justice and psychology. So hope I can implement, practice what I preach. I can't tell everyone to do these things and provide all these therapeutic interventions and then also neglect myself at the same time.
It's perfectly understandable that that would happen. And you are not the first one. Look, thank you for everything. Marie, this has really been great. And you know, I knew going into talking with you that it would be extremely worthwhile for me and for anyone listening. And I'm sure there are thousands listening. I know that to be true. Not only because of you telling your story, which I was had my fingers crossed the entire time that that thing would have completely 100% ended. Feels like it's about 99% ended. So I hope I get an email one of these days saying, okay, it's completely over. But still, with your internship, the probation internship with the high-risk DV offenders, you know, that's really interesting to me, because getting someone who is an offender or an abuser to come on is impossible. I mean, it really is. Any insights into what that world's all about, I think, is extremely valuable, because these people feel entitled to the behavior that they put out there, to the physical problems and emotional problems that they put on other people. They feel like somehow they feel like it's what they have to do, you know, that not that necessarily it's okay, but it's like, well, that's what I have to do. You know, they feel like they can justify it. But I just want to thank you so much, because you've really
absolutely
given us a lot to think about. It's really great. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on. And thank you for getting me on by sharing your daughter's story, because if it weren't for you, I wouldn't have been here. So thank you for the work that you do as well.
Well, I appreciate you, and I have a lot to do still, right?
Yep, absolutely.
And you know, for people listening, I hope that they'll hear something maybe, and if they know of someone in their life, could be themselves, that they say, wow, that sounds like what I'm going through, or that sounds like what my sister's going through, or my mother, my parents split up, my mother's got this person she's interested in, maybe that's bad news, or somebody you know at work, somebody you know on your street, that you will stop, really look at it, consider alternatives, get some professional help one way or another, whether it's a therapist or it's a domestic violence agency counselor, somebody like that, but do something. Probably the easiest thing to do is to call the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which is 800-799-SAFE. Give them a call and just chat, and you can stay on as long as you want. They're not going to pester you. They're not going to send a SWAT team to your house just because you said certain things. All those things are good. But Marie, thank you very much, and thank you for giving us your focus and your time today.
Yes, thank you.
You are welcome. This concludes our conversation with Marie. It's not often to have an interview with someone who we hear about her story, her dating violence, dating abuse story, but also her internship, which I found vastly interesting. It gave us insights into high-risk domestic violence offenders, and we see how they have absolutely no empathy. They broadcast the fact that they don't really intend to change. They are just going to game the system for a period of time, and then when they don't have to do that anymore, they'll just slide back into what got them there in the first place. So that's really disappointing, but if it's the truth, it's valuable to know. Thank you for listening to the When Dating Hurts podcast. We have been steadily moving up in podcast review rankings based on downloads in the relationships category. That means more and more listeners are getting the kind of advice that can improve lives for victims, survivors, and their families. If you feel we need to hear your story, do not hesitate to email me at BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. That's BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com.